Chariot Solutions TechCast number 26, an interview with pragmatic programmer Andy Hunt. On the show today, we talk to ETE 2009 keynote speaker Andy Hunt. Andy is the co-author of the seminal book, The Pragmatic Programmer, and co-founder of the Pragmatic Bookshelf with Dave Thomas. After an absolute killer of a keynote on Friday, I sat down with Andy for a quick interview on topics related to the book Pragmatic Thinking and Learning. Afterward, we feature some audio from our Wednesday evening event, The Deconstruction Zone. It was a family event with lots of noise, but with a just cause. Now let's go to my interview with acclaimed author and speaker, Andy Hunt.
All right. Well, Andy Hunt, thanks a lot for sitting down with me for a little bit. You had a great keynote, or you were talking about the material that was part of your book, Refactoring Your Wetware. And I thought it was just a fantastic topic. Where did you get the idea for this?
When Dave and I first wrote Pragmatic Programmer back around the turn of the century, doesn't that sound horrible?
Yeah.
But I mean, that was 10 years ago now, and you know, our goal then was to try to make developers' lives easier, and we actually didn't start off to write a book. We were just going to write a white paper for our clients, you know, answering some of the same questions that kept coming up, trying to make development go smoother and more easily. And of course, that you know, became a book, which is still, you know, I'm flattered to see people refer to it as a classic. You know, it always comes up on people's top 10 lists of books, and you know, it really was to an extent sort of beginner's luck, because we were just, you know, we were consulting actively at the time. It's like, okay, this is the stuff we thought was important. And really, this book came about kind of the same way. You know, from the original tips in Pragmatic Programmer through to, you know, the first pickaxe, the first Ruby book, through all the starter kit books on unit testing, our involvement in the Agile Manifesto. You know, Dave and I were two of the 17 authors of the Agile Manifesto, so we were heavily involved in that movement. And at a certain point, you know, it occurs to you, it's like, okay, well, we've tried all these things. You know, we've tried methodology, we've tried, you know, various other levels of tips and languages and what all, but, you know, at the end of the day, none of this has really been the silver bullet that's changed things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, I guess the thing, the real turning point for me is I saw one of these statistics that said that the number of bugs per 1,000 lines of code has been constant.
Right.
Since, like, you know, 1960.
Forget the methodology,
yeah,
for
exactly.
The technology,
the
right?
The language, yeah. You know, all this great stuff has changed, and you know, we're still kind of screwing it up. So, you know, then it's like, okay, well, what's constant throughout all this? And of course, it's us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's developers. So it occurred to me, I actually started looking to see, well, what's been written on, you know, sort of tuning your thinking and learning and tuning your brain to be a better developer, but, you know, better creativity and invention and whatnot. And it was funny because I remember one of the books came out. I don't remember if it was Mind Hacks, but it was something like that. One of these books came out.
Book, yeah.
and I was like, oh, they beat me to it. You know, I was all disappointed. This was a couple of years back. But then I got, and there were several books out at that same time, and I checked them out, and I was uniformly disappointed, because there seemed to be a focus on, you know, here's how to memorize a list of 10,000 numbers.
Right.
It's like, well, great parlor trick, but, you know, this is not going to help me in my everyday job.
Mm-hmm.
This is just, it's, you know, to use the word, it's not pragmatic.
Right.
It's not helpful. So that really spurred me to say, okay, there's a lot of good stuff here. You know, there's a lot of new research, new functional MRIs, mapping things in the brain and seeing how it's far more complicated than people thought, you know, before that time. There's a lot of interesting stuff here. What can we cherry pick from this research and these thoughts to get the stuff that is actually useful to us? You know, not just memorizing lists of numbers or you know, these kinds of tricks, but stuff that would really help. So then I started finding things. What really got me into it was, as I got to a certain level of research and investigation, and I started finding these same threads coming up in wildly different areas. Things from, maybe learning research where you would expect it, but then, executive and MBA courses where you wouldn't, or writing courses, or drawing courses, or yoga, or, whatever. Just these wildly different topic areas that you get to a certain point, it's like, oh, look, these people are saying the same thing as these people over here. So when I started seeing these sorts of correlations, it's like, okay, I must be onto something here because, this comes up again and again in these different guises and different contexts. So then I started looking at it more carefully. I started giving talks on this topic probably around starting, 2003, 2006, somewhere in that range, and only really started working on the book in earnest in the last, 2 years or so. And as all books, it takes forever.
Sure, yeah, right.
But I'd had the talks to go on, so I had feedback from audiences and a lot of questions and tidbits, folks who attended one of the talks would contribute their experiences. Well, this happened to me, and I heard about this, and have you seen this book, and so on. So it really grew into kind of a thing. And I have to say, this is the seventh book that I've written or been involved in, and of all of them, this, I think, has generated the most amount of reader feedback. I get lots of email, occasional phone call, mostly email from folks who, are really, surprised and ecstatic at how helpful this has been to them. And at some level, it's kind of a shame because, this is, the most effective stuff here is fairly obvious.
Right.
And has been known for a long time. Take mind maps as a great example, right? And this is, every time I give the talk, I ask the little survey question, have you ever heard of or used mind maps? And when I do that here in the States, crowd of 100 people, 2-3 hands go up, right? Usually. And I ask it in Europe, and it's the exact opposite. Everyone's hand goes up except, one or two foreigners who came in from the U.S.
Right.
It's a very simple but effective technique. It's widely taught in Europe in primary school levels, and it's not particularly widely taught here in the U.S. There's some pockets of it there, here and there, but it's an extremely useful technique when you're trying to do exploratory thinking or take notes on something, and you're not really sure where it's going to go. It has distinct cognitive advantages over an outline or anything that has an implied hierarchy to it already, because that's going to tend to squeeze out thoughts that might not fit just right. And, at that stage, you want sort of loose tools for loose thoughts. You want something that's wide open and that you can work with. So, there's a very simple thing. It's widely known and practiced in other parts of the world, and really not widely used or heard of here. So there's a lot of little things like that that make a tremendous difference that, I'm almost embarrassed to even mention it because, it's so simple. I think the number one idea out of the book that people have just raved about is probably the simplest thing in the entire book. Just always carry something with you to jot notes down on, whether it's a cheap little notebook or a fancy Moleskine, or you can get a nice steampunk Moleskine with a etched brass cover on it, whatever.
Right.
Just something so you can jot that thought down when it comes. Really, can you get any simpler than that? Again, I get the email constantly saying, wow, what a huge difference that made, with whatever, the people were embarking on. So a lot of it's like that. I found it interesting going through the various research and the papers and findings and whatnot, how a lot of things that were once taken as hard scientific fact turned out not to be the case. It turned out, really, that's just an old wives' tale.
Right.
That doesn't actually work. We thought it did. For 30 years, we thought it worked that way. We were wrong. And conversely, some things that people kind of dismissed as, that's just an old wives' tale, actually, no. The functional MRIs are showing it does sort of work that way. But it's been interesting in that regard because, it's such a complex piece of machinery. The hardest thing the brain can do probably is try to understand itself. You see a lot of things that are mostly true, but you start digging into them, it's like, well, it's very hard to pick anything and say, this is categorically true. Everything depends on context. It's like, well, this is true for most people. This is true in most circumstances.
Right.
But, and some folks have written in and they want, an absolute black and white, this always works, this never works, I want to see hard scientific fact. And it doesn't work that way. It's the brain. It doesn't work that way.
Right. And everyone's slightly different.
It's
everything, a lot different.
Individual differences are tremendous. Mm-hmm. The whole issue with neuroplasticity, the fact that you can rebuild areas of neurons in different places depending, anytime. Right. They could do the best mapping in the world and say, okay, this always happens like this in most people, and then for various reasons, you can do it differently. And the best case of that, and this one stunned me, they actually trained a fellow to see using his tongue.
I've heard of that, yeah.
They took, and it was a
sensory
small,
imaging kind of projection, yeah.
A small sensory element. It was like a 16 by 16 grid that they tied in to the underside of his tongue, and they were able to train that portion of his brain to recognize images enough that he could drive through a parking lot with in between cones.
I think I've heard, and I wanted to take you kind of down the R mode world for a couple seconds, because I'm a musician and have been since I was a kid, and I'm sure you are too. What's your instrument?
I mostly play trumpet, flugelhorn, and keyboards.
Fantastic. I'm a jazz drummer now, and I've been drumming since I was, 12. And I had a music teacher, a drummer. I came in, told him I wanted to be a heavy metal rock player at the time, War Pigs or something. And he said, just sit down, don't talk, and start playing. Just start tapping out rhythms with me. And his biggest advice to me was, if you think, you sink, which is hilarious, but it's getting that analytical mode out of the way.
There's a lot to talk about there. Different personality types come into play, different learning styles come into play,
absolutely.
And it's all valid. And this is the real drawback, because we've got some definite cultural pressures that say that, well, you have to take this very linear, analytical view of the world. That's really how most college programs are set up. That's how most companies reward employees, is based on this very, sort of linear, L-mode biased kind of approach. And, yes, that works great for a percent of the population who thinks that way and has that personality type, and it does not work well for others. And there's nothing that says that, this is more valued than that or vice versa. It's all context. And, of course, most people aren't a strict stereotype one way or the other. They're somewhere on the spectrum.
Right, they're on a continuum. Yeah.
So, but yeah, it all comes into play. Whether it's personality, even generation, when you're born and your peers comes into play on what cognitive biases you have and what styles you are more or less comfortable with. It all comes into play, which again just makes it that much more complicated.
Yeah.
There is that stereotype of the programmer, as you say, being very linear and plotting and step by step, and there is a lot to be said for that. That's very true, and that's why I get a lot of very positive reaction when I point out that it doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
You can begin to cultivate these processing styles that you've neglected and you've been taught to neglect. It's interesting looking at the Betty Edwards, who wrote Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, who popularized a lot of these concepts back in the late 70s and early 80s. She made the observation that these sorts of ways of thinking can interfere with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now like the most popular drawing method on the planet, based on that same idea: if you think, you sink. And trying to get that gibbering monkey of the L mode to sort of step out of the way and let other cognitive processes take the stage, if you will. And it's just fascinating to see, when I tell these stories and mention this to developers, you go to any primary school filled with six-year-olds in kindergarten or something and say, who can draw? And everyone raises their hand. Right? There's no fear, there's no self-criticism, no self-judgment. Of course, everyone can draw. Duh, you take the crown, boom, off you go. You go to a set of high school students or college students and who can draw? You go to one of these conferences and say, who can draw? And the two folks who slipped in from marketing, will raise their hands.
Right.
And everyone else is like, I can't draw. Not me, man.
Yeah, my brain definitely told me eventually I couldn't because I wouldn't listen to the feedback. Right?
Exactly. And you know, it's funny because that is very much a cognitive limitation. I mean, if you have the physical skill to, you know, sign your name and put marks on paper, you can draw.
Right.
That's not the hard part. The hard part with drawing is seeing. And that's where this dichotomy of the L mode processes and R mode processes sorts of comes in, because the L mode is frantic to throw out a symbolic representation.
Attach meaning, right?
You know, and we do that, and we have to do that. I mean, that's not a drawback. If we didn't do that, we would drown in input. So you say hand, and your L mode says, oh, I know, that's five sticks in a line. You know, you get the little cartoon image of it.
Right.
And so the whole point in drawing on the right side of the brain and these other drawing techniques is to get beyond that symbolic representation and really look at the negative space, the light, the shadow, the texture, you know, all these other attributes. So the interesting thing to me is, while that's a true you know, way to approach drawing and sort of physical art like that, you could say the same thing is true if you're interviewing a user about requirements, right?
Yeah.
You're interviewing somebody and they say, well, then we take an invoice, and your brain says, oh, invoice, I know what that is. And you stop listening.
Yeah.
And you don't realize that they're using these words differently.
Right, your preconceived notion isn't necessarily what they mean
to say.
Absolutely,
absolutely. And it's, you know, for eons, we've recommended people maintain a project glossary in that particular case, because the words the users use may not be the words you use. And
right,
it would be very helpful if you had a consistent naming convention from user speak all the way into objects in the code and you know, what have you. That's just one example. So there's a lot of things that, you know, you might see this in the context of learning to draw, or, you know, meditating while you do the dishes, or whatnot, that's totally applicable in the software development arena.
Right. It's funny, I mean, even from just the R mode side of things, as a drummer and as a musician, you know, and then, like, it's a lot of different technologies or skills, you get into some sort of flow, and it becomes not automatic, but it becomes really, I guess it's R mode processing.
And it's interesting you use the word flow, because, of course, that was the book by the famous psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, which, you know, it's a good thing this is recorded, because if I had to spell that out for
good
you,
luck.
Yeah, I'd be search on Amazon for it.
Exactly.
But you know, highly decorated, fellow in this field, and you know, classic book Flow and a couple follow-on works that discuss exactly that. And his thesis is that not only is that, you know, something that occurs, that's actually the ideal state that we're trying to get to. You know, everything else, you know, money, sex, power, whatever, all boils down to trying to achieve this sort of state of flow. And he lays out the criteria for what it entails to get into flow. And if you look at it, yes, it looks suspiciously like a lot of these other things that try to quiet down that overactive L mode, which has that kind of idle loop of that chattering voice in your head. You know, and again, you know, similar to meditation, yoga, you know, lots of these other martial arts disciplines that all have the same aim, you know, to try to kind of curtail that from running wild and let these other processes come to the forefront. And unfortunately, if you look at sort of the arc of our culture and technological history and industrial revolution kind of path and whatnot, we needed those skills to get where we are today. We can't rely on those same skills to take us to the next step. And Dan Pink makes this point in his book, Whole New Mind, spelled W-H-O-L-E, where, you know, he looks a bit at the, you know, sort of economic underpinnings of commoditization and whatnot to say, okay, yeah, that was great, that got us here, but that's not going to be sufficient to move into the next century and move ahead. And this, you know, it's funny, because, I mean, this goes down to a very basic argument. There's still a large number of organizations, companies, corporate entities who don't fundamentally believe that programming is a creative, inventive endeavor. They think you just get a couple business analysts and one guy with a bright idea,
yeah,
and you ship it off to some low-cost country and monkeys bang it out on typewriters, and, you know, there you go. Not realizing the you know, when you're hiring a software developer, you're not hiring a code monkey, you're hiring a problem solver.
Exactly.
And And, you know, stunning as it is, that message has not reached a lot of corporate America. You know, the clever ones get it, and most of the rest don't understand that still. And that's where I'm really headed here. It's like, yes, that is what we're supposed to be doing. We are problem solvers. We happen to use code, you know, as our primary tool. But, you know, I can count a large number of projects that I've done and Dave and I have done together where we ended up, as a consequence of getting them a software system that would work, recommending changes they had to do to their business because it just didn't make logical sense. It wasn't consistent. It wasn't coherent.
Right.
You know, whatever it might be. And that's not programming, you know,
right,
necessarily.
It's problem solving. Correct.
So that's, you know, getting back to your first question, that really was the focus of this book. It's like, all right, well, we really need to spend some time and energy, you know, looking at foundations of invention and creativity and intuition. And I mean, this, you know, this was a fun book to write. It's 300 some pages. It was barely scratching the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, folks like Edward de Bono have written tons of books on creativity and thinking and problem. And there's, you know, tons of work out there, most of which few programmers have ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, it's not required of any curriculum anywhere. It's really not something we look at. And, you know, I think that really needs to change. This needs to be something that gets more widely addressed.
I would agree. You know, I saw Dave Thomas talk, I guess in 2004, 2005, and he was talking about, you know, software being an art as well as a practice, and that, you know, you create something out of nothing, I think was his quote, every time you sit in front of a keyboard.
I remember that talk well. We did that.
It's a great talk. Yeah.
We did that for the first time at Jaub in Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really great talk because, you know, it was one of these things where we didn't have any bullet points. It was all just pictures of great artwork.
Exactly.
And we had so many requests for that, but of course, you know, we didn't have rights to any of these artwork to reproduce it or anything, so I couldn't like put it up on our website. So I actually did a transcription of that, and I've got an article form of that talk that I posted like a year later, or something that is still up there. But yeah, and you know, again, you know, you start off with the premise that, well, programming is an art, and half the audience you lose right away because like, no, they're not. It's an engineering discipline.
I'm out of this,
and I'm out of here, and they're not. You know, they shut off their brains and aren't listening. And you know, that's one of these cultural biases we have to get over.
Yeah.
You know, we very proudly put the picture of a plane, a wood plane, on the cover of the Pragmatic Programmer to indicate, you know, yes, this is a craft.
Yeah.
There is a craft to this. There is an art to this. And there was a raging debate on comp.object back in the day of news groups around that time where, you know, they were using the word craftite derogatorily. It's like, well, you're not a real engineer.
Not for crying out loud.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was, you know, this was a very serious line of thinking at the time. And so we tried hard to sort of disabuse people from that. It's like, no, it is a craft. There is art to it. There is invention. There is creativity. You know, this isn't just code monkey, you know, patch cable banging out ones and zeros.
Right. Huge thank yous to Andy for being part of ETE and agreeing to sit down for an interview. Let's take the podcast out, listen to audio from the Deconstruction Zone, an interview with Ken Fink, president and founder of Watergy, the company that ran the event.
What's up, the laser? I bet you, Liam, I bet you if you guys unscrew the case, you can take that laser out in one piece.
I've done screw so many things. I don't think we
I've been waiting to see
laser.
What's inside a laptop
because it's not an actual like
laser. Right, yeah, it's just a little like beat, right?
Yeah, it's kind of better, I think.
Right now, the destruction zone. Someone's using a bat to destroy a copier. Just like Office Space.
Nice. Look at this. The circuit board?
What? I'm gonna get two.
Really old print circuit board here. I don't know if it's old, but it's kinda very simple. Pretty cool. Computer eyes, you get the
So what I wanted to know was where did you come up with this idea besides watching Office Space?
that's easy. I would say this idea, it's not a new one.
Right.
I think I had it when I was around, maybe around 2 or 3.
Taking things apart.
Took Absolutely. Things apart. My parents had to chase me around because I wasn't so good at putting things back together back then.
I had the exact same problem.
And the cool thing is, it's really rewarding to take stuff apart.
Yep.
There's all this stuff hiding right under your nose.
Dad, it's the curly chip.
What'd you find?
The woman chip.
Ah.
The what chip?
The woman chip.
The woman chip. Oh, what do you mean? Pink?
Yeah.
Just because it's pink? I like pink. What color are you wearing?
Uh-huh.
So
that's my boy.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, he's... He's also been the first person to recognize the music. Everything's video game music.
Yep, awesome.
So the thing that you realize when you take stuff apart is there's all this magical stuff hiding under your nose. It's not really magical, but as things got fancier and fancier over the years, they made them more and more hidden and harder to fix.
Right.
And everyone had to have the newest and the greatest and the best. So as we were putting this together, Chariot asked us to put this together for this conference. Mm-hmm. So thanks to you guys for that.
Awesome.
And in doing the research, what we realized was the stuff, after you take it apart, it's got to find some place to go.
Dad, your job is way cooler than we thought.
Good to see you.
All right.
Is that you, Wayne?
After you finish using stuff, if it breaks, if it becomes obsolete, everyone wants new every two and the most exciting, newest gadget, which is great, except then you got all this stuff left over. What happens to it? And there's a lot of stuff in there that you really don't want to end up drinking, breathing, eating. Solder that you put all of those parts together with is usually about 40% lead. The old computer monitors were made with leaded glass for a reason. You ever put a vest on when you're getting an x-ray to keep the wrong parts from getting x-rayed?
Right.
That's lead.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what?
Shielding.
To keep yourself from getting x-rayed and really beta-rayed from the monitors, that you'd put lead in the glass.
Right.
What do you do with all that stuff? So, and the problem is, recycling it is not the easiest thing in the world.
Right.
Sometimes it is, because if you grind up computers, you can get some lead out.
Yep.
In fact, I think on average, about 3 tons of computers will give you as much lead as about 17 tons of ore that they would have had to get the lead out from rocks.
It's already been refined.
Exactly. So you can re-refine this stuff, but you have to actually do it. What'd you find?
What does that look like to you? It looks like a video card, doesn't it? Maybe.
So what do you think those are?
Yeah.
In fact, speaking of gold, it looks like Liam found some gold right here.
Yep, gold connectors.
And you can get that gold back out and melt it down and use it again. Mm-hmm. Some of those chips have other things in it that you do want. They also have a lot of stuff you don't.
Right.
And one of the big problems is you got to find a place for the stuff if you can't figure out how to get the metals out.
It just rings a bell, but it's...
And a lot of times they end up getting buried in landfills. A lot of times they end up getting hidden in other places.
Right.
Or worse, a lot of times they end up getting shipped off into other people's backyards.
Yeah, I think I heard an NPR article or something where they have people in China, is it? Where they're stripping...
Africa,
like, literally they're stripping and smelting and melting up, like ribbons of cable, and all the toxins are coming up into the air.
Absolutely.
And then they're busy raking up what's left and trying to melt it down.
Yes.
It's horrible.
That's actually a picture from, I believe it's Nigeria, where it's one of those towns where all that stuff gets built up.
So where does this stuff go then instead?
Well, we've actually got Chariot helped work together with us to find a recycler.
Okay.
We're not the recycler.
Right.
He's not the recycler, but his goal is to go around and collect the stuff, and he's got a bunch of recyclers already lined up, and he's already come down to Philadelphia to pick a bunch of other stuff up, so he's going to take it away. Some of it's going up to Virginia, some of it's going up to Maine, some of it, I believe, is going out into the Midwest to either get reused or recycled or really broken down.
Great.
None of it's going to end up in a landfill, I've been promised. And frankly, I want to thank Chariot for helping, for inviting us to put this together. But I'm so excited about it. I expect it to be happening a lot more.
Right.
So we're looking for sustainable ways that we can sustainably dispose of the stuff so we can keep doing this regularly.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Stick around. Not only will you be taking stuff apart, but pretty soon we're going to introduce a challenge, since we've got all these great parts around, of something to do to put the stuff together.
Oh, just
excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Special thanks to the organizing committee of ETE for making it such a smashing success. Also thanks to Ken Fink for his interview at the Deconstruction Zone. We have some fantastic podcasts coming up over the next few weeks. Our guests are going to include Emmanuel Bernard, speaking about Hibernate Search, his upcoming book, and Beam Validation. Recaps of sessions from Philly ETE, including Joshua Franklin Hodge from Blue State Digital, the group that ran the Obama New Media campaign, Red Hat open source visionary Michael Tiemann, Jason Van Ziel on OSGI and Maven, and many more. In these shows, we'll link to presentations so you can follow along with the audio. Our podcast theme is Free Theme Number 3 from podcastthemes.com. We love to hear from our listeners. Email us at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com or visit our show notes page at techcast.chariotsolutions.com and leave a comment. Until next time, I'm Ken.